to the POS didn't support this particular machine. It's like all the other 715s, 712, everything, not the 715-33. So I heard about the Puffin Group organising this port of Linux to the PA-RISC, and I joined in. I ported the Hill driver over from M68K. I wrote the BinFormat SOM loader, which I'll go into a little bit more later, and then they offered me a job. So here I am today. I'm going to go through the PA-RISC architecture. We have a number of different models of processor. The PA-RISC line goes back to 1985, approximately. We started out with the PCX processor, which was the very first processor and has a number of difficulties which make it quite a hostile architecture to run Linux on, and we don't actually intend to make Linux run on the PCX processor. Then we have the PCXS, the PCXT, the PCXT Prime. These are all 32-bit processors. They're used in a number of workstations and run at somewhere between 48 to 120 megahertz. We move on to PCXL and PCXL2. These are also 32-bit processors, but they're an effort to produce a low-price design by integrating the bus interface into the processor. It's a much more integrated design, and as such, was much cheaper to manufacture machines based around these because you didn't need all the extra chip circuitry that you normally do. And then we have the 64-bit processors, PCXU, U+, W, W+. All the new HP machines use the PCXW or PCXW+. They're also referred to as the PC, as the PA8500, PA8600. These processors run around about 120, all the way up to 550 megahertz. Devices. Most machines have at least some of these types of devices in them. The Ethernet device is always a commodity part in the machines that we're actually interested in. Some of the older machines have proprietary Ethernet, but these are the machines we don't support for so many other reasons anyway that we don't care. Reviews. Intel 82596, otherwise known as the Apricot. There's already a driver for this. DEC Tulip, if it's 100 megabit, or the Altion chipset for gigabit Ethernet. These drivers already exist. The only trouble was porting them, and we'll get into that a little bit later. SCSI is a similar story. HP have always used the same line of chips, even though the manufacturers changed over the years from Emulex to NCR to Symbius to LSI Logic now. They're typified by, for example, the 82596 driver or the 700, 710, 720 NCR chips. Serial, mostly standard, 16450 based or compatible, apart from one example. HIL, the Human Interface Loop. This is basically USB done 15 years ago. It was in use on the HP 300 series, which were the Motorola 68000-based machines. There are HIL keyboards, HIL mice, and some interesting other devices, such as wheel boxes and button boxes. We have some examples of those, but I didn't manage to bring any with me today. PS2. Eventually, HP gave up pushing HIL and moved to PS2 on the workstations, simply to reduce costs, use more commodity parts, and that's used on most of the more recent workstations. The really recent workstations use USB, and we haven't supported that yet. there's some issues which I'll go into near the end of the talk. Buses. HP have always used... HP started off using their own proprietary buses for I.O. CIO, NIO, SGC, GSC, HSC. There's a massive terminology associated with this project, and if I'm confusing you or losing you, that we have a glossary on the web page. These buses were always significantly faster than the equivalent PC buses of the time, and were a major performance win. But HP did realize that sometimes customers needed commodity hardware, and they provided EISA and then later PCI adapters. The third category, the runway, ropes, summit, Merced. These are really internal buses. They're either processor buses, or they go between two different I/O controllers. WAX is an EISA adapter. So typically you'll have a GSC bus, and then WAX will sit on the GSC bus and convert to an EISA bus. Dino and Cujo are PCI controllers. Dino's 32-bit and Cujo is 64-bit. They also convert from GSC. U-turn actually sits directly on the runway bus, and the runway bus comes directly from the processor. Astro also sits on the runway bus. Astro's a more advanced form of U-turn. Astro doesn't convert directly to a PCI bus. It converts to a ropes bus, and then on the ropes bus we have Elroy's, and Elroy converts from ropes to PCI. So we get to the workstations. The first series of workstations were called the snakes. I'm still not quite sure why, because some of them are fish. But the workstations as a whole were codenamed snakes. There aren't many of the original series around, and we tend to neglect the testing and development of those machines. We do have a couple, but we don't test on them at all. Those were replaced with the 715 Scorpio, the 725, the 735, and the 755. Excuse me. These were slightly more popular. They were significantly faster. They used the PCXT series processors. There were a lot of machines around. The 715-33 that I found is an example of the 715 Scorpio. These machines in their turn were replaced by the 712 and the 715 Mirage series. Thanks to HP marketing, we have difficulties distinguishing between the two series of machines, but Scorpio and Mirage seem to be the accepted terms. The 712 is probably the most successful PA RISC machine ever. We have a lot of them, and we're trying to give some away to people who are interested in helping with the development. Come and see me if you want one. You can take it home with you today. Then, after the 712 and 715, HP started lettering the machines. All the workstations, sorry, all the servers have letters, T class, J class, sorry, K class, and so on. And then they took the workstations into this line. B, C, and J are workstation letters, and all the other letters are servers. So the C100, C110, J200, J210 are PCXT Prime based. These are probably the fastest 32-bit processors around. They were replaced with the second series here, the B132L, B160L, C180L. The L suffix here shows that these are the large-scale integration machines. That's the PCXL and PCXL2-based machines. Then we also had the C160 and C180, which are the first of the 64-bit workstations. That's a PCXU CPU on a runway bus, which is bridged to the GSC bus. And these machines are equipped both with EISA and with PCI. These were superseded by the C200 Plus, C240 Plus, J2240, which were based on the PCXU Plus, so faster processor. These have 32 and now 64-bit PCI, so these machines contain a Cujo as well as a Dino. But they don't have EISA slots anymore. By this time, EISA was a dying standard, and HP didn't feel the need to support it any longer. The C360 at the end there replaces the PCXU Plus processor with the PCXW, but is otherwise architecturally unchanged. And now we come to the workstations which are still in production. The B1000, 2000, C3000, J5000, J7000. These are all PCXW-based machines, PA8500. Again, processors on a runway bus, bridged to a PCI bus. These are Astro and Elroy-based machines. The earlier machines were U-turn or U2-based. The C3600, J5600, J6000, these are really recent. They've only been out a few months, and these are PA8600 PCXW Plus based machines. Servers. The first PA RISC based machines were servers, and these are the ones which use the PCX CPU, the very old one that we don't want to support. They have HP proprietary devices, attached to proprietary buses, and really there's no existing documentation, externally to HP available documentation available on these devices and buses. And there's not a lot of incentive for HP to clean up the documentation and release it for public use. So these machines will probably never be supported. That's the E, F, G, H, and I based machines. There are some that were introduced before the lettering became the standard nomenclature. So those machines are also just not going to be supported. D, K, and R will probably be supported at some point in the future. They're reasonably similar to the early C-class machines, the C110 and J210 machines. The T-class is unlikely to be supported. It was a top-end server in its day, but it's kind of strange, and we don't think we can feasibly support it in any reasonable way. The V-class is the current top-end machine. It's big, it's fast, it's scalable. We'd love to get Linux running on it, but realistically, we're way off being able to do it. We think we can do it, but it's going to be tough. So we're ignoring it for the moment, but it's in the back of our minds. The A180 is an interesting machine. This was the machine which HP shipped to developers initially. HP shipped 12 machines to developers to help with the port. Architecturally, they're the same as the B180L, the B180L workstation that we talked about earlier. It's a 2U rack mount machine. It's incredibly noisy, and it was a good choice of machine to develop on initially. It's architecturally, again, very similar to the 712 and other machines. So it was a good basic machine to start with. And finally, we have the L and N class machines and the A400, A500 and A550 machines. They're the current target of our efforts. We're trying to get Linux booted in 64-bit mode on these machines. They're architecturally similar to the recent BC and J machines, the ones which are still on sale, the Astroy and Elroy-based machines. The trouble is that these machines have to be booted in 64-bit mode. The BC and J machines can actually be booted in 32-bit mode, but these machines can't. Quirks of the PRS processor. The PRS processor has a virtually indexed, though physically tagged, cache. Initially, we thought we needed to implement page coloring in order to have correct behavior, not just for performance, which is where page coloring normally crops up, but to actually have correct behavior. And Philip Rumpf wrote a quick, dirty, hackish page coloring implementation. But we looked again and discovered that we were wrong. Linux actually has sufficient support in the VM system for virtually indexed cache processors to give us correct behavior. So we removed the page coloring because we didn't need it any longer. And the search for a good page coloring implementation for Linux continues, but that's the subject of an entirely different talk that I'm completely unqualified to give. SMP. The problem with SMP is that we have only one SMP primitive. We only have the load and clear word instruction. Okay, there's load and clear double word as well. But nevertheless, most architectures provide either more complicated instructions, such as x86 provides atomic, load, increment, store, and jump. Which is nice. It's great. RISC architectures provide the primitives. Most other RISC architectures provide the primitives that x86 is using to do that. They have the load locked and store conditional modifiers. So when you ask it to do the store, it checks to see whether somebody else read from that area of memory. And if they did, then it jumps back and tries again. So you get the atomicity, and you can do arbitrary instructions in the middle, but you don't have the really complicated instructions. But PA-RISC only has load and zero. So effectively, to implement the more complicated instructions, even XJudge, XJudge macro is defined to atomically exchange a value in a register with the contents of a memory location to atomically switch them over. And even to implement this simple primitive, we have to basically spin lock around the implementation. We've considered multiple possible implementations of this, including one particularly perverse one I devised, which checks in the interrupt handler whether it's interrupted a critical section and jumps back, modifies the address of where it's going to return to after it takes the interrupt. But in the end, we decided it only actually saved us one instruction, and we decided that the additional complexity in the interrupt handler was just too much, and we decided not to do that. It would also be a uniprocessor-only optimization. Yeah, so we have to implement XJudge, atomic increment and test and set bit, And the trouble is that we're going to be basically locking around each of these operations. And using the strategy results in the CPU spending a lot of time acquiring and releasing locks, and indeed enabling and disabling interrupts on the processor while you do it. And I fear that we're turning into IRIX a certain amount more than I'd like. However, there is hope. There seem to be some machines which have atomic operations implemented in the memory controller. There's some debate about exactly what's happening here. We're waiting for HP to provide some final word on exactly what's going on here. We really don't know quite how this is going to turn out, but we actually have bigger problems than this to fix right now. Cache coherency. We have, as I already said before, a virtually indexed cache, and on the x86, the DMA controller interacts with the CPU caches, and whenever there is DMA to or from a device, it ensures that the device is getting the data from memory, the data which was last written by the CPU. Even if it was still in the cache, it gets pulled out of the CPU cache by the DMA controller. We can't do that. There's a... The dynamic DMA mapping was thought up by Dave Miller. Dave, are you in the audience? No, I guess not. Okay. He proposed this initially for Spark and Alpha, but it solves our problems too. The dynamic DMA mapping, the driver says to the kernel, give me some memory which I am assured is cache coherent. And what we can do is that some of our systems have what's known as an I.O. MMU. That is, the DMA controller has its own MMU, which we can then program when a driver says, give me some memory which is coherent. We can then program the I.O. MMU of the DMA controller to know about that region of memory. And then it can interact with the CPUs in the cache coherency protocol. And that's great, because that fixes the problem on everything from the PCXT prime on upwards. Okay, technically it doesn't fix it on anything with those processors in it, but all the machines produced which have those processors in them has an I/O MMU. So we're sorted for those. But that still leaves a number of important machines, such as the 712, without support. However, those machines, the PCXL and PCXL2-based machines, although they don't have an MMU, they do support uncacheable pages. And this is a reasonable alternative, because rather than all the device driver has asked for is a region of memory which is consistent. And if that region of memory is uncached, then the CPU isn't caching any writes to it, so it all goes straight through to memory, and then the DMA just picks it up from memory automatically. Accessing those memory areas is slow because it's not cached, but it's correct. And it depends on exactly the architecture, but on many architectures, this is actually faster than flushing the caches after doing writes and before DMA is performed. However, that still leaves us with some problem machines, the PCXS and the PCXT, the 705 all the way up to the 755. Because these machines don't support uncacheable memory. The processor supports uncacheable regions, that's fine, but the memory I.O. system doesn't support non-cache line transactions. So we can't just write a byte into memory. It just won't get there. The machine will crash. So these machines can't implement the dynamic DMA mapping. interface. Luckily, none of these machines actually support PCI. So we don't need to go and modify all the PCI device drivers, which is great, because I went through putting flush caches in the Tulip driver, and it was a complete nightmare, and we didn't catch all of them. This was before the dynamic DMA mapping interface was proposed. So these machines will have their own special device drivers anyway. And in these drivers, we can insert the explicit cache flushing calls that we need to provide correctness on those machines. Next set of quirks, IRQ regions. On most architectures, there are interrupt lines running to the CPU. And when a device wants to generate an interrupt, it pulls that line high, and that triggers an interrupt in the processor. Not so on PA-RISC. On PA-RISC, interrupts are done by a device writing onto the bus and saying, I've got something to tell you. And this is true for CPUs in a multi-CPU system. Each CPU can signal using this method, and it's true for devices as well. So we don't actually have interrupt lines as such, but the whole Linux interrupt system is based around having IRQ lines and IRQ numbers. So we have this design called IRQ regions, which was designed by Grant Grundler and Philippe Rumpf. And this design associates bits in the transaction which is written to the CPU with interrupt lines. It provides a virtual interrupt service, in effect. It's slightly complicated by our requirement for hierarchy. In a system, we can have many bus adapters. So, for example, on the runway bus, there is a runway to GSC adapter, and this will multiplex all the GSC devices into one interrupt. And then the GSC devices themselves may be PCI bridges, and then each PCI device has its own interrupt that it can generate. So we need a hierarchy, and this provides us with these services. PCI devices are actually fixed up during the PCI bus walk. And so, again, this allows us to use the PCI drivers unmodified using these virtual IRQs instead of the actual IRQs they are expecting to have. User space. Hooray, he's got out of the kernel. SOM versus ELF. HP designed their own their own object file format called SOM. It stands for Spectrum Object Model. So all 32-bit HPOX binaries are in this SOM format. So one of the first tasks that I had was to write a SOM format loader. And this was actually not too hard. It's considerably nicer than the ELF binary loader. But hey, I'm biased. Nevertheless, we needed that to run HPOX binaries. And this is how we started, is that we wrote the binary loader for SOM, and we wrote emulation for a sufficient subset of HPOX syscalls that we were able to get an HPOX binary, a shell, up and running. Sash, indeed. We then had some difficulties because we were still compiling the kernel as SOM, because this was all that the GNU tools that we had available were able to do. HP sponsored Cygnus to provide a 64-bit toolchain which would compile 64-bit ELF binaries. HP actually dropped the SOM format when they went to 64-bit executables, and they switched to using ELF 64-bit, just like everyone else. So Cygnus completed this work, and we took their binary, and Sam Creasy provided us with some quick and dirty hacks that got the kernel building as ELF. These days, the kernel is more and more reliant on being built as an ELF executable. It uses several tricks which are available in the ELF executable format to increase performance and reduce the interactions between different parts of the kernel. David Huggins-Danes and Alan Modra have been hacking on the toolchain recently, and we have now provided with a much superior, properly done implementation of ELF32. It's getting there. So, with our toolchain solved, for at least for the moment, we turn to glibc. Ulrich Drepper has done some work here, and many people have contributed small bits of code. Paul Bain of HP has done a lot of work, and so has Matt Taggart, in getting glibc up and running. We're still not at the stage where we're building shared executables. I saw the CVS commit messages this morning that showed that Alan Modra is getting a few steps further towards getting shared libraries working, but as he said himself, it's not ready yet. It's not finished.
The ABI is also still a bit in the air.
I'll just repeat that. The ABI is still very much in the air. It's not defined terribly well by the documents we have from HP, because HP never implemented 32-bit ELF. So we're having to make it up as we go along, which is good in some ways and bad in others. So we also had to decide on a distribution to port. We had a little discussion, distributions being the emotional issue that they are.
Not so much as comment characters in assembly language, but...
It basically turned into a toss-up between Debian and Red Hat.
They're falling out.
That's IBM's fault.
Oh, okay. yikes. So, we had people who were experienced with both. And eventually we picked Debian. It makes a lot of sense for us. More people on the project are familiar with Debian than are familiar with Red Hat, particularly within HP. Although Alex DeVries did do the Red Hat to MIPS port, so we did have experience on both sides. But we settled on Debian because of the package maintainer system, and this means that each package has its own Debian maintainer. We can submit the patches to the individual maintainers, and they'll take care of getting them accepted upstream with the maintainers of the packages. We felt this was going to be more likely to succeed than getting Red Hat to submit all, trying to submit our changes to Red Hat, or trying to get all our patches to all the different maintainers, all the different packages ourselves. The Debian maintainers either are the original author or have a good relationship with the original author of the package. So it really made a lot of sense to go with Debian. How are we doing? Well, the kernel is based around 2.3.99 pre-8. We're keeping up with Linus's changes to the kernel, even though I realized we're 2.4.0 pre-5, test 5 pre-2, last time I checked. We don't shift every week, you know, otherwise we're not accomplishing anything. We're just staying at the same level and just with the latest version of Linux's kernel. We have to take some time to do our own developments and get more stable. We tend to merge every 2 to 3 months with what Linus has done. There are a number of devices where support is either non-existent or flaky. The frame buffer device is ongoing. The floppy drive isn't supported yet. I found in my mailbox yesterday morning that apparently we're having trouble with the HIL drive on certain 715s. I need to look into that. In the B2000, C3000, J5000 series of workstations, we have trouble with the integrated device from National Semiconductor, which has which they deny all knowledge of. There is no data sheet for this chip. They deny it ever existed. There is no price for it. We can see it. It's here. We have to try and get
data sheet. It's wrong.
We have to try and support it, but we're not sure if we can support it within the PCI subsystem. We're having some... It's a broken device. We're going to have to try and pludge around it somehow, and we just don't know how yet. Yes, it's called Sucky.io. Oh, Super. I always get that wrong. 64-bit support. Yeah, we're working on it. I think I've managed to get it out of head.s now. I'm not quite sure, because I haven't written the bit in 64-bit that would actually print something to the console. But I can see where it crashes, and it looks to me very much like it's actually managed to execute some C code. So, fingers crossed. User space. We're basically building Debian packages as we go, as we need them. Matt Taggart at the back is doing most of the work on this. Do we have a native GCC yet?
Yeah, sort of. We can cross-compile. I don't think we haven't managed to bootstrap it on the system yet. We can cross-compile a GCC with, you know, build equals i386 host equals HPPA.
Okay, we haven't managed to bootstrap the compiler on its own system. So, okay, ongoing work.
Configure itself, and then the kernel crashed.
Right, so the configuration scripts work, okay? we need more work in the memory management layer. We currently crash every time we get a page, every time we get a segmentation fault, which is highly suboptimal.
It does have the advantage, though, that in the absence of a debugger, you can debug your user space programs by looking at the register dump results.
Again, yeah.
Often all that tells you is, oh, look, it's segfault on malloc. But, which was really a lot of fun when that happened. Because that actually turned out to be a kernel bug. But anyhow.
Yeah, we haven't even touched on the subject of a kernel debugger yet. We're talking with HP about taking the HPUX kernel debugger, and the stick is that otherwise we'll simply use SGI's kernel debugger, which might be politically unwelcome. I'd like to thank everyone. Thank you all for coming. And thanks in particular to these people who have contributed so much of their time and effort to this project. Paul Bame, Grant Grundler, John Marvin, Matt Taggart of HP, Alex DeVries, Richard Hurst, David Huggins-Danes, Alan Moja, Martin Peterson of Linux Care, Thomas Bogendorfer, Helga Dell and Philip Rumpf, of no particular company, just people who fancied hacking. And Alan Cox, Sam Creasy, Ulrich Drepper, and Jeff Law have also given much of their time to this project. I'd like to thank everyone. Working with these people has been such joy. It really has. If you want to know more, the paper, which will be in the proceedings, I promise. I did do it in time. And I put the tech file on the FTP site. I've put a PDF there now as well. The project website contains all this information, and these slides are linked from the website. Beg pardon? The hardware database. Yes, I haven't put that on. The hardware database is also linked. This is one of the... Yes, I am. This is one of the best things about... the best source of information we have. Oh dear, the wireless LAN doesn't seem to be working. Could someone open the door at the back? No, it's okay, I'm just joking. The hardware database is really cool.
Let's watch Netscape take 100% of CPU while it's trying to resolve an issue.
Okay, stop. So, that's the end of the talk. Does anyone have any questions? And there's a guy at the back with the mic. No questions?
Yes.
I can't believe my talk was that good. Oh, that's it. It's just too bad. No one understood. No one liked me. I'm going now. Thank you.